mouth.
Word of 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 mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. America loves amateurs. The country was founded by dilettantes and enlightened rebels. Cities, farms, and businesses were seeded by adventurous greenhorns and neophytes. Writer Jack Hitt argues that the DIY spirit that generated untold numbers of patents and subscriptions to popular mechanics drives the country's success and identity. Popular TV shows like The Voice and Project Runway continue a long tradition of discovering and rewarding new talent. The Mark Zuckerbergs and Sergey Brins of the world remind us that college dropouts and immigrants are still creating ideas that fuel economies and our daily lives. Jack Hitt has plenty of credentials as contributing editor to the New York Times Magazine and This American Life. He's author of A Bunch of Amateurs, A Search for the American Character. Jack, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Virginia. Just FYI, we'll be carrying on this entire interview in Dothraki from the Game of Thrones.
Oh, well, no problem. It'll just take me a little while to translate on traduque.net. Well, you know, you love the amateur. You call them the errant knights, sometimes pretentious, sometimes obsessive. What is it that attracted you to the amateur?
Well, actually, this whole thing came up when several years ago, a book editor and I were having lunch, and he said, "Have you ever noticed that a lot of your stories involve like some kind of crazy obsessive who actually sort of is slightly on to something, and sort of you seem to be obsessed with these sort of amateur people?" And I don't know, as a freelance writer all my life, he sort of noted that perhaps what I was really interested in was some kind of justifying kind of autobiography here. But and he suggested that I collect a lot of these pieces into a book. And then I realized that I'd rather just go off and write even newer pieces, but pursue those characters who I realized that they're sort of this a very American character. And what I liked about it when I first started looking into it is just like, in every generation, you sort of hear this line that the age of amateurism has just passed. Mm-hmm. It was just last time, last generation. Our time is so much more sophisticated and complicated and complex, and we couldn't possibly have any amateur pursuits in our time. And then a Steve Jobs comes along, or Mark Zuckerberg or somebody who walks out of a dorm room or a garage and invents a new future. Mm-hmm. And we're like, oh, right, I guess it's still happening. And so my whole argument is that there's a kind of cycle that happens, and I think we're sort of, especially with the economy and the toilet, we're sort of cycling right into one right now.
Well, you do. You write about this cycle of the dabbler versus the Protestant work ethic, the Puritan virtue versus pragmatism of a deist, and beautifully illustrated in this story early in the book about the arrival of Ben Franklin and John Adams at the court of Louis XVI of France at Versailles. Now, this is the first vision that Americans that Europeans had of America, this strange new breed. I know it's a long story with a lot of backstory, but can you kind of pull it together for us?
Yeah. First of all, I love the story. I'm a fan of all the founding fathers, but these two particularly are the twin poles of American everything. You have Ben Franklin, this kind of, improvisational deist, and then you have John Adams, this sort of hardworking, sort of always focused Puritan, and by chance they show up constantly together throughout American history. And at one point in 1778, they're in Paris. Both of them have been assigned the task of getting money and an alliance from the King of France so that we can win, because we're getting our heads handed to us at this point, 2 years into the Revolution. And Adams is sent over there to watch out over Franklin, who already has this reputation as this kind of boozer and womanizer, right? And so he gets there, and Franklin won't even meet with him. He's like, "I'm very, very busy, John. I don't have any time." But he does hear about Franklin, and Franklin is parading all around town in like a coonskin cap and these weird boots, and he's the only sophisticate we had in America at the time, and yet he's running around looking like Davy Crockett, and there's a wonderful moment that I just wish we had a transcript of what it must have been like. But Adams is going to meet King Louis XVI, and this was a very elegant process. You were supposed to dress up in sort of various laces and vest coats and breeches and buckled shoes and, you know, a powdered wig. You're supposed to carry a sword, you know. And there were even like little knight suit mongers outside of Versailles where you would go rent this getup. It's sort of like when you go to prom, you rent a tuxedo. There was a whole sort of like knight's outfit rental shop right outside of Versailles. So, of course, I just have this image of Adam showing up there all decked out, you know, and then and then Franklin appears and he gets out of his carriage, you know, probably in this like this crazy coonskin cap outfit that he had on. And I just try to imagine John Adams, this very straight-laced, you know, Yankee Puritan, looking at Franklin going, what are you doing? You know, you madman. And of course, Franklin like, John, you don't get it, do you? That this is who they think we are. You know, they think we're a bunch of woodsmen who just appeared out of the forest, you know, instead of carved a new nation out of the jungle. This is how we're going to get the money. I'm going to let them see what they want to see, which is the American sort of frontiersman, this natural man, this amateur man. And of course, Adams is eventually sent home furious. And you know, Franklin proceeds, and of course, he got us the money, mm-hmm. and he got us the arms, and we won the revolution.
Well, this sort of, you know, the I think you call it something like the banshee scaling the walls of the experts or something. You know, this we're somebody to be taken seriously, but there are good reasons for professionalism, right? There's reliability, there's protection and standards. Do you dislike the experts?
No, not at all. And in fact, of course, you know, most amateurism winds up, you know, nowhere, and much of it winds up in utter madness. You know, I'm not making the case that because you're outside of sort of the fortress of expertise that somehow makes you right. It often, more often than not, makes you very, very wrong. You know, I mean, if you look at all these amateur genealogists like still running around, you know, goofing off with Obama's birth certificate, or let me make a prediction. By the end of the summer, Mitt Romney's affiliation with Bain Capital will somehow be inflated into some insane notion by conspiracy theorists that he's a member of some like Bavarian Illuminati. You know, you just know that's going to happen because this is what just goes on when you follow amateur pursuits. But there are plenty of cases where these sort of fortresses of expertise can generate kind of inside the bubble thinking. And that the outsiders are often the ones that do have the kind of clear picture. And often the best way for that relationship to happen is through some kind of pro-am cooperation. Can I just give you one example?
Yes, please.
Okay. So, if you look at astronomy, astronomical discoveries are made by universities and by NASA and so on. There's no question about that. But there is this army of self-taught, you know, weekend backyard astronomers. And they, if in my chapter, I just point out that, you know, there are tens of thousands of these people who are doing like real solid, you know, kind of collaborative research with the professionals all the time. So they're not just alone in their garage sort of scheming like new theories that overturn Einstein or something like that. But, you know, they understand that there, you know, there is this sort of like great pile of knowledge, and what they hope to do is just add a little bit to it through the kinds of contributions they can do. So just to give you one quick example, a few years ago, NASA downloaded through Hubble like, you know, a million images of galaxies, and they needed to be sorted and identified and whatnot. And this would have taken decades, you know, for a department of astronomy to do this. Mm-hmm. Instead, they just created this thing called Galaxy Zoo and basically taught amateurs how to go through this process. And 150,000 people signed on. And within the year, they just cleaned out the whole, you know, collection of images and it was all done. So there are ways in which, you know, amateurs contribute to real professional knowledge in a healthy way. That said, a lot of what we were talking about earlier, the madness, yes, the crazy
the
goofball.
Coonskin cap.
The coonskin cap guy. They're out there, and I'm sure I'll be hearing from them over the next little while.
We're talking with Jack Hitt about his new book, A Bunch of Amateurs. Now, he speaks with zealous birders, garage tinkerers, weekend archaeologists, rogue biologists, and other passionate, innovative amateurs which he says drives America's success and very identity. Well, let's talk about someone who's stepped into it. James Chatters, working out of a converted rec room in his house. He's credited with discovering, he actually found about the discovery from some neighborhood kids, of a nearly full skeleton on the banks of the Columbia River near Kennewick, Washington. Ended up throwing fuel on a big political fire. What happened?
I don't know how many people remember, but Kennewick Man was this skeleton found in the river bank out in Washington State about 10 years ago or so. It launched this huge fight between Native Americans who claimed that the skeleton, which was roughly around 8,000 years old, belonged to the nearest tribe, and under the federal law, you know, they had control of the skeleton. Scientists, though, and this amateur archaeologist, Chatters, fabulous name for such a person, said that he looked at the skull and saw that it had
Caucasoid-like
features. Now, it's a wonderful phrase. Caucasoid. I asked an anthropologist, I said, what's the difference between Caucasian and Caucasoid? He said, oh, Caucasoid just sounds more scientific. And, of course, Caucasoid-like just takes you a little further step beyond reality out to some kind of maybe yes, maybe no. And, in fact, you know, the skull was found in pieces, and so he had to put it together. So when he saw the Caucasoid-like features, whatever those were, and they were just head shapes, right, he sort of launched this fight that would last for years. In fact, in some ways, it's still going on. His that word implied that it wasn't an Indian or Native American skeleton, but something that predated the arrival of, you know, the Native American population, which we now still believe came through Alaska, mm-hmm. the Beringian Straits, and, you know, from Asia. This was implying that it came from the other side of the ocean, right, the Atlantic Ocean. This is a wonderful, fabulous misunderstanding, but it's one that just shows you the whole danger of amateur pursuits. With that one little word, he launched these amazingly erroneous arguments that just multiplied and turned into this really incredibly, almost ridiculous American sort of hoopla. For example, after he said that word, a neo-Aryan group that wears like Viking helmets and horns and big furs, they went out to Washington to, quote, claim the skeleton as their Native American ancestor. And they had like a Viking funeral over the bones out there. I mean, so, you know, you really get the sense of just how insane the whole sort of thing can sort of just a cascade out of control. By the way,
yeah,
the scientists finally won the right to own the skeleton, to study it, you know, arguing that it was not of Native American extraction and therefore could be taken by the scientists and taken off somewhere to a lab and studied. That was many years ago. I've called and called, and all I can hear is like, we're still studying it. Uh-huh. What have we learned? Nothing. Why? Because it's a Native American skeleton.
Perhaps, yes. You know, in the hands of the experts. But, Jack, we have just 2 minutes left, so I want to ask you something about yourself. I mean, mm-hmm. you talked a little bit earlier about, like, is this you sort of trying to, I don't know, understand the outsider as somebody who's drawn to those people? You are also the author of a solo theater performance, Making Up the Truth. Now, this alludes to something a lot of people admit to, feeling sort of like frauds, like they don't really have the credentials to do what they're supposed to be doing. So quickly, could you wrap up for us what that feels like for you?
Well, I mean, my show is really about how the brain, it's a bunch of stories that I've told over the years, you know, real true life stories, supposedly. But it's also about how the brain pre-edits reality and even before we perceive it. So the stories that you tell and that you perceive are actually already pre-edited by your brain almost precisely for you. But it also, I mean, the show also taps into the side of the sort of creative side of what it is to be Homo sapiens. And in some ways, it does sort of parallel what some people who study amateur pursuits show, which is that if you're not trapped by conventional wisdom, if you're not trapped by received convention, that you often have a way of seeing new things and discovering new possibilities, precisely because you're not encumbered by the great heap of sort of professional wisdom that's been, you know, taught to you in schools. And I give many examples in the book of outsiders who overthrew decades, centuries of perceived wisdom, because they didn't know originally what they were talking about.
Jack Hitt, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
Jack Hitt is a contributing editor to the New York Times Magazine, Peabody Award winner, whose stories can be heard on CDs from This American Life and The Moth. And there's much more on his new book, A Bunch of Amateurs, dedicated, as he said, to those unburdened by expertise, at wordofmouthradio.org. Now, in the background, we're hearing just such a guy, Noah. He's an aspiring singer and high school student from South Carolina. He posted a video of himself playing an acoustic version of I'm Sexy and I Know It on YouTube on May 9th. 2.6 million hits later, he was on the Today Show this morning.
Ooh, I'm sexy and I know it. Yeah, I'm sexy and I know it.
Coming up, an argument for piracy from content makers. That's when Word of Mouth continues. I'm sexy.